Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowain. They were the names that became household words by the summer of 73. Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Dean, Liddy, names that became synonymous with the Watergate scandal and the subsequent daily televised hearings that mesmerized the nation. There were other names, too, names like Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, the Washington Post reporters who broke the story 40 years ago this week. The names Woodward and Bernstein would become synonymous with investigative reporting and would raise the bar for a generation of journalists to follow. So this hour, we take stock of investigative journalism in the post-Watergate era. How did that single story change journalism and the public perception of it? And how has investigative journalism changed since then, and who continues to do it well today? Our guests know a thing or two about the profession. Jim Steele is with us. He is a contributing editor for Vanity Fair. He is perhaps best known for the many years of award-winning investigative work that he and Donald Barlett did for the Philadelphia Inquirer, including that landmark series, America, What Went Wrong? Charles Lewis is a professor and founding executive editor of the Investigative Reporting Workshop at the American University School of Communication in Washington, D.C. He's founder of the Center for Public Integrity and the guiding force behind Investigating Power. It's an online multimedia archive of great investigative journalism over the last 50 years. And a little later on, we'll hear from Associated Press investigative reporter Eileen Sullivan about her Pulitzer Prize-winning series on American Muslims and the New York Police Department. Let me begin by welcoming you, Jim Steele, to Radio Times. So good to have you with us.
Nice to be with you, Tracy.
And Charles Lewis, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us.
It's great fun. Thanks.
Well, so we have to talk about Watergate, huge anniversary this week. Charles, you have interviewed Woodward and Bernstein about the work they did. How did that story change journalism and the way we think about it?
Well, you know, in the history of the United States, there actually is no single moment where journalism basically challenged authority in terms of the information, and it's the only time in U.S. history a president resigned. 70 people were convicted and of crimes, of abuses of power, and for the press, it was that in the Pentagon Papers case, which occurred in June of 71, about a year before the break-in. Pentagon Papers and the Watergate scandal are probably the high water mark in terms of the credibility and the public respect, I think, or other sentiments towards the press. It was a seminal moment in U.S. history. There is no more important single moment. If you ever had to pick one, that would be the one.
Yeah. Jim Steele, I'm thinking you were at the Inquirer at the time that the Watergate story broke. What was it like for you as a journalist to follow that story, both in the paper or on television? What was it like back then?
Well, Donna and I had actually been working as an investigative team for a couple of years before that, so we were, of course, glad to see investigative reporting get this kind of spotlight to begin with. And just as Chuck's saying, the whole concept of challenging power. It was a remarkable thing, and I think the thing that people forget about Watergate, at least a lot of the public does, is that everybody realizes what it did now. But in the very beginning of that coverage by Woodward and Bernstein in the Washington Post, there was tremendous criticism of the work they were doing, and people forget that now. Newspapers around the country, a lot of editors questioned them, raised all kinds of points that they were going down blind alleys, they just had some agenda. But as more and more pieces fell into place and people saw exactly what had happened, saw that abuse of power that Chuck just mentioned, then that attitude shifted and there was tremendous support. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that's very important about investigative reporting. I mean, for all of these focus groups where newspapers go out and they find out, do you love us, our readers, what we're doing, and so forth, the fact of the matter is, when journalists are doing their jobs in the beginning of controversial stories, probably a lot of people do not like them at all, because people do not like bad news. They do not like things that question leadership. It is only when it is clear as a bell what has happened that support then comes in fully.
After the fact.
After the fact, exactly.
Yeah, it's almost a badge of honor when you're getting that sort of heat.
Exactly, precisely.
And Charles, you talk about that in some of the interviews that you've done, that the Post itself, you know, not only Woodward and Bernstein, who were perceived as maybe a couple of young upstarts at the time, but the paper itself took a lot of heat for a long time around that story.
The Washington Post did twice as many stories as say the New York Times or any other publication. They were out front. Within 48 hours, they knew that this involved the White House after the break-in. And the White House, not surprisingly, tried to isolate the Washington Post, and fairly successfully. For 3 or 4 months, the Post was denigrated by other newspapers who actually ran editorials criticizing the Washington Post for its coverage. And but over time, other things happened. A federal criminal investigation, various grand juries were convened. We all remember the Sam Ervin Senate hearings that came into effect, and a Republican-appointed judge, John Sirica, basically didn't believe the story of the burglars, and eventually one of them cracked and told the whole story. Folks in Congress, both Republicans and Democrats, it was a Democratic-controlled Congress, both House and Senate, but the Republicans had to, some of them had to stand up and say, wait a minute, this really is wrong. It took about 2 years for all that to play out, and of course the tapes, we all remember the tapes. there was a recording inside, recordings going on in the Oval Office, and eventually the tapes showed that, you know, President Nixon had lied pretty consistently for 2 full years, and all of this was an incredible drama that, honestly, the nation has never had before and hasn't had since. And it's an extraordinary time. There's no other way to describe it.
Jim, we're living in an age of reporters having, and people across the spectrum of the business, having to do more with less, as everyone else is doing
exactly.
in this economy.
Mm-hmm.
How are these young guys able to pursue this story the way that they did with such a sort of singular focus? How are they able to pull it off?
Well, this is an excellent question, and it really goes to one of my favorite issues about the whole Watergate investigation. If you come back with us to that time, and I know Chuck remembers a lot of this as well, there was a lot of comment once the case had sort of been cracked and what Woodward and Bernstein had done. There were all kinds of stories and cons, like how could these two young guys off the metro page of the Washington Post crack the biggest story of the century under the noses of the flower of American journalism in Washington, D.C.? Absolutely one of the silliest things ever uttered, and you saw that continually. And this is no disrespect or taking anything away from Woodward and Bernstein, but what happened was, once they got onto this story and the Post realized what they had, the Post committed resources to follow that story. And that's the difference. And when you get back to investigative reporting and you see what makes it work and what doesn't work, time is the great ingredient. This is before there were databases. This is before there were all kinds of other marvelous tools that we have now as investigative reporters. You need the time to follow the string of things.
Yes.
And that's what the Post did. And they did it early, and they did it fully, and they committed it tremendously. And that's why, more than anything, this story got cracked. Now, as I say, this doesn't take anything away from Woodward and Bernstein, because you could have given those resources to somebody else, and they would never have unraveled this. They just happened to put those resources in the hands of two very, very capable, expert, hardworking guys who cracked
yeah.
the case.
Well, and it's funny how they talk about, you know, being on the B team working on Saturday when the stories broke
right.
and just, you know, it sort of fell in their lap in that sense, and then they had what it took to really follow through with it.
Exactly. They sensed what it was, and the Post also had a sense, and some of the mid-level editors and higher editors at the Post committed stuff from day one. And that was really the yeah. difference.
And Chuck, that's the issue now, right? I mean, the lack of resources, the lack of time, even though there are, as Jim said, some great tools. I mean, there was no Google back then. There was no internet. We've got all of that technology at our disposal. And yet, not necessarily the resources and even more critically, maybe the time to chase right. these things down, right?
No, exactly right. I mean, just to put it, just another sentence, looking back, there were 11 reporters and editors at the Washington Post on Watergate the first morning after the break-in. 11 people. And then when you look at 2.5 years that Woodward and Bernstein, well, 2 years and 3 months that they worked on it from the break into the resignation of Nixon. They had an editor who oversaw them for basically a year and a half, every day, 7 days a week. News organizations don't have these kinds of resources now. We have one-third fewer newspaper reporters in America than we did 20 years ago.
One-third, Chuck.
One-third.
That's
We've
huge.
Lost 20,000. There are half as many reporters in the Philadelphia area today as there were 20 years ago, or back in the late 80s. And so when you cut the number of reporters, or when they're gone, like canaries in a mine shaft, you're not going to hear things, you're not going to read things. And the other thing that I find very concerning is the number of public relations people whose job it is to put a spin and happy face on things sometimes, the number of PR people has doubled in the same period of time. we've lost some truth tellers, and we've gained some other types who are not always deeply interested in the truth. And so it's all very serious. I mean, it's extremely serious. And it affects our country, and it affects what the public thinks and knows about things. If there's no one telling them or digging stuff out that is important like this, it couldn't be more serious.
Well, and then, Jim, there's the issue of the 24-hour news cycle, right, and trying to generate lots and lots of content, or at least to repeat lots and lots of content
right.
throughout the day. And it's become kind of like retailing, about volume on some level, right?
Absolutely, and I think this is one of the things that newspapers in particular are trying to sort out. When I broke into this business a number of years ago, the 1960s, there was a tremendous concentration on sort of breaking news, not like we have nowadays, because we didn't have Twitter, we didn't have news networks within the cities that I worked in at the time. But the idea that you followed every conceivable kind of breaking news, I mean, that was important. But even then, people were talking about standing back and looking at broader stories, broader issues, things that might stick with readers a week or two after one of these breaking news events had passed. And that's what's interesting to me. We're, in a way, back to there. We need more of that than ever. But as Chuck has pointed out very, very well, with this reduction in staff, it puts more pressure on just those kinds of truth tellers who can stand back and do the more reflective stories. So I think all of us are wondering, ultimately down the road, where the business is going in terms of that business model. What's going to make it possible to at least preserve those people who can give us those enterprise stories, those stories that we won't forget, the stories that have can change politics, can change the way we look at our communities. So we all want to know the answer to that, and I don't know anybody who really has that answer.
Well, Chuck, I'm going to give you a try at that in the 30 seconds we have left before the break. But your thoughts about where the business is headed, and we have much more to talk about, too.
Well, the business is headed towards, I mean, there will always be important journalism. Look at the Pulitzer Prizes this year. Look at the reporting in Pennsylvania on the Penn State matter, broken by a 24-year-old woman, the second, Sarah Ganim, the youngest Pulitzer Prize, second youngest Pulitzer Prize winner in history. So there are still great reporters out there, and there's now a movement of nonprofits doing investigative reporting, about 65 of them. 60 of them started since 2006 when some of the economic things started to happen. So,
well, I want to talk to you about that, Chuck. In fact, I'm going to stop you right there because we have to take a quick break. Much more to come. We're talking about the 40th anniversary of Watergate and how journalism has changed in the years since then. You're listening to Radio Times.
Take Us Home supports WHYY. A group of Ethiopian Jews is waiting in Ethiopia for a chance for a new life in Israel. Many have waited for 10 years or more, living in mud huts with no water or electricity. Fukadeh and his wife are finally told that the wait for their family is over. But if they go, they must leave their adopted son, Worku, behind. Take Us Home is a new documentary film by Eileen LeBlanc, premiering at Philadelphia Independent Film Festival, Thursday, June 21st at 6 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church on Chestnut Street.
This is Jeff Bundy, WHYY's Director of Member Relations. WHYY's fiscal year ends on June 30th. The last 12 months have seen the first anniversary of our NewsWorks Tonight program and the 25th anniversaries of Radio Times and Fresh Air. Now is the time to lay the groundwork for the next fiscal year and beyond. I hope that you'll consider making an end-of-fiscal-year donation to WHYY before June 30th at whyy.org. Thanks.
WHYY is proudly supported by the new University Medical Center of Princeton at Plainsboro. This new hospital is now open. It was designed with all single-patient rooms and innovations that may help improve healing and lower infections. Features include a rapid-response emergency room and physicians from the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia to care for children. The new University Medical Center of Princeton at Plainsboro, redefining care. Now open. More at PrincetonHCS.org.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. Can you believe it's been 40 years since Watergate broke? And we have been talking about not only Watergate, but how journalism has changed since then. Certainly the names Woodward and Bernstein became household words back then, and there was a new emphasis on investigative journalism. So we're talking about how the profession has changed, and investigative journalism in particular. Our guests are Jim Steele, who is one half of Philadelphia's own legendary investigative reporting team with Donald Barlett. You might remember the series that they did. They've done a number of them, but America, What Went Wrong was a landmark series that they worked on. They are Pulitzer Prize winners. Chuck Lewis is with us, founder of the Center for Public Integrity and the guiding force behind Investigating Power, which is an online multimedia archive of wonderful investigative journalism over the last 50 years. We're going to hear from another Pulitzer Prize winning reporter in just a little bit. But when we left off, Chuck, and I apologize for that, we were talking about the direction that the business is going in, and you said we're always going to have journalism, but it's, you know, what form is it going to take? So I'd like you to finish that thought before we move on.
Well, folks around the country realize we have a civic crisis, that we need more journalists than we have. And so there are now something around 60 or 70 nonprofits, 17 of them at universities, where professional journalists are working and also making sure students know about this as well, so it's not hieroglyphics. And some of the most important investigative reporting, public service journalism that's done in this country will be done in collaboration between a lot of these nonprofit centers and the sturdy remaining news organizations that actually have, you know, newsrooms that can try to cover the news. I mean, to put what's happened over 40 years in another set of perspective, we have the same number of reporters we had in 1972 during the Watergate break-in. The problem is we've added 100 million new people in America. And so the issue is, how do you keep up with the changing times of the United States, and how does the profession that's been beleaguered in recent years keep up? And what's happening is it is changing a little bit between all the online exciting new things with innovations you can do with documents and data and searching and all that kind of stuff, and you can do it globally in a nanosecond, do a story that has ramifications on planet Earth literally in a nanosecond. That some of the technologies are kind of exciting. The role of citizens, you know, could actually, cell phones and subway bombing, they can show stuff that the press couldn't get to. And so you've got the role of citizens getting more important. You've got the internet that can be irritating and terrific simultaneously, but it's a new force. All these things obviously were not around during Watergate. And so I'm actually hopeful about the future, but obviously it's been a very difficult time for the profession. There's no other way to say that.
No doubt about it. Before we go any further, let me invite our listeners to join in the conversation. Do you remember Watergate? Remember days and days of hearings throughout the summer and all those familiar names that kept popping up? Do you have a story to share or a remembrance of that time? Perhaps you're a journalist. We'd love to hear from you. The number is 888-477-9499. We're talking about the 40th anniversary of Watergate and how investigative journalism in particular has changed since then. Chuck, you gave us so many things to talk about in what you just said, and I want to go back to organizations like Journalism in the Public Interest. That's an online resource. In fact, we've had some reporters from there with us on Radio Times. Are those kinds of websites and organizations gaining traction right now?
Well, they are, partly because of the vacuum that's being created. We need additional people. A lot of the folks, I have tracked these nonprofits, and about 700 or 800 journalists with prior professional experience in the commercial realm have moved over to the nonprofit realm. And around the country, communities are, foundations and individuals are supporting this kind of work because they realize if you don't have information, you don't have a community, very bluntly stated. And so there is something that has been very interesting to watch over the last 5 or 7 or 8 years that's been unfolding here. And, you know, we forget NPR is actually only 40 years old. You know, that's a nonprofit, by the way. You know, and the only one in America to double its audience in the last 10 years. And so the nonprofit realm has become more significant as the commercial realm has become more beleaguered. And so that plus the new technologies are the new world we find ourselves in.
Jim Steele, let's talk also about the trend of investigative journalism moving from newspapers to books.
Mm-hmm.
What's that all about?
It's probably, there's always been a combination between the two.
Mm-hmm.
And so many books, because of the, in so many newspapers and even magazines, there very often has been a smaller news hole to tell stories. So books have become a marvelous way to tell very complex stories. I mean, you mentioned our America, What Went Wrong series back at the Inquirer in the early 90s. That was one of the most revolutionary newspaper series ever on several levels. One was the sheer length. It was basically book length, mm-hmm. and that was unheard of at the time.
And what was it, about nine? Was it nine installments?
Nine parts, 70,000 words. That's a book.
Wow.
In fact, we have a new book next month that's about 75,000 words, so it gives you an idea of what these are. So books will let you dig into subjects the more complex they are in a way sometimes other mediums won't. So I think there's probably going to be more and more of that, and it's also a reflection, I think, of how investigative journalism has changed. I mean, one of the things that Watergate did give a great emphasis to, by focusing on the value of this kind of in-depth journalism, investigative journalism went in many, many new areas that it rarely went into in the past. And one of those is it began covering corporate America in a way that it didn't. I mean, Don and I did all kinds of things after from the early 70s on about that issue.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you go back in the 60s and the 50s, almost none, no coverage of that sort. That was just something that newspapers didn't do. It wasn't a rule out there that you don't do it, but it just wasn't thought of, or you were discouraged or whatever. So the other thing that's happened is, if you go back in history, so much investigative journalism focused on one person or maybe just one company as to what they were doing and revealed that, exposed that. What also happened from the early 70s on, and the whole emphasis on Watergate investigative was very helpful in this regard, people began looking at systematic failures, government agencies, commercial enterprises, things across a whole field. Don Bartlett and I did a series back in the early 70s after about this time on the international oil industry, explaining how during an oil crisis there really wasn't a shortage, but through various things, supplies had been manipulated, and everybody but consumers came out on top.
Yeah.
Prices went up, supplies appeared to be in short demand, so on and so forth.
Yeah.
But anyway, that was one of the great pluses, a systematic look at some of the bigger, broader-based problems affecting the society, and again, the wherewithal to go after that at the time. So that was another, I think, tremendous plus that came out of that period. And we're still seeing that.
Yeah.
Any of us journalists who judge a journalism contest today, we will see those fingerprints still on many, many series.
Yeah.
So good work continues to be done.
And Jim, is there a necessity to move in that direction, in the direction of books? Also because I'm thinking about young people, and we were talking before the show about people getting news from their iPhones and
right.
their Androids and that sort of thing. And will there be an appetite for people to read a 7 or 9, you know, piece series off their cell phone when they could read it from their, let's say, get the book and read it on the e-reader?
I'm not so sure I'm the best one to answer that question. I certainly have a cell phone where I'm capable of doing that, but I'm still a little old-fashioned on that. I have a tablet, as most people do, and you can certainly read these things on a tablet. I think with the exception of the cell phone, all the new devices lend themselves to long, in-depth articles and pieces.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what's the difference between a tablet and reading a book, if you think about it?
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing. A book can be 300 pages, it can be 700 pages, if you're reading it and you're interested. The heart of everything will always be the same, and this is what was so exciting for a lot of us who were at the Philadelphia Inquirer back in the 70s, was that we wrote long articles, many, many people did, but there was a tremendous emphasis on the writing of those articles to make sure that the story moved forward, that we gave the reader a break, that if it's something complex was coming down the pike, tell people this is happening and say, stick with us, you're going to like this, ultimately. So tremendous energy was expended to make those readable. And I think that was the big change also under investigative reporting. Long pieces before that, sometimes they would just be dumped into newspapers and reporters couldn't figure out why somebody wouldn't read them. You have to go that extra mile to make things. That'll be truer than ever in the new era.
No doubt. And I that brings up a couple of things. Chuck, you mentioned the rise of citizen journalists. And I'm just thinking that that's one of those double-edged sword kinds of things.
Right.
Talk about that and how, you know, what an impact that has made. Because now everybody's got a camera on their phone. Anybody can create a blog and call it journalism. And there are, I would think it's a good news, bad news kind of thing.
Well, no, that is, I think that's a fair assessment. We have something like 300 million websites in the U.S. alone, which is about the same number of people. And so it's deeply worrying that, you know, everyone is now a journalist, everyone and no one or something. So it's very confusing. On the other hand, abuses of power frequently occur outside where journalists are working. And so someone with a cell phone or someone leaking a document that is important and reveals an abuse of power is incredibly important. So we have a wheat and chaff problem, is how to, with all that blizzard of information, and a good amount of that is opinion-based, so it's not, you know, it's not really fact-based in most cases, or in many, many cases. And so we're in this very strange transition. We've got to remember, we've only had the, most people have only had the Internet for 15 years. I mean, this is still in its relative infancy. So I think over time, this will all keep changing. Literally, it's changing almost daily, these technologies. But there is something to the public having more participation in their own democracy, and actually, if they see things, telling the world about it and it being able to do it and not having some Mount Olympus gatekeeper situation where only a select few will decide what's newsworthy in the world. So I actually find it very interesting, and I don't quite know where to come down on it. I think there are a lot of net gains to it, but I also get frustrated when, you know, we have a country where the same number of people think Rush Limbaugh is a journalist as Bob Woodward in polling. We are confused as a people about what journalism is and what truth-telling actually is, and that's a long conversation. We'd need a couple weeks to talk about that.
Well, and that's something I'd like for us to spend a little bit of time on. I think you're absolutely right. We could talk about it forever because I think there is a lot of confusion. And getting back to the whole citizen journalist thing and the technologies that are available, on one level that is attractive, particularly to the broadcast media, because now you've got these reporters that you don't necessarily have to pay who are contributing content to your website, to your television broadcast, whatever it is. And we were talking, Jim and I, before the show, just about the cost of all this in a time when newspapers are in decline, when there are, as you pointed out, fewer and fewer reporters. Going forward, who pays for the work that's being done, for this kind of investigative work that needs time, that needs resources, in order to let it breathe and to figure out where the truth is in the midst of all this? Jim, I'll ask you first, and then Chuck, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts as well.
Well, I think we covered some of the strands that we see developing. I mean, Chuck talked earlier about the nonprofit world and the collaborations with existing institutions, both magazines, newspapers, and for that matter, books as well. So there's some of that. Whether or not this is just a transition period into something else is something I don't think any of us totally know. But the cost is a huge issue because it's not so much a matter of travel or buying things. It's simply a matter of the salaries that you have to pay people to do this kind of work. And it does take time. And the citizen journalism can be, I think, very helpful in pointing people in certain directions about what may be out there. So in other words, the ability to get tips, the ability to get leads is stronger than ever. People can communicate in a way they just couldn't in the past. I mean, theoretically, somebody could have written me a letter 20 years ago about something, and people did. But the ease of which you can do it now, people find your website, people find your Twitter account, whatever it is, and boom, they can get stuff to you, and they can tell you about things. That's, without a doubt, a tremendous plus. But in terms of paying for it, it's really a big issue because any of us who have done this work, we know how many potential possibilities there are for mistakes and the ramifications for that.
Yeah.
So just the verification information is tremendously difficult, which is something not always appreciated by all citizen journalists. But if they're used in part as leads, as a way to get on things, to find things, I think it has tremendous possibilities.
Yeah. And to ultimately, in the right hands, get to the truth.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Let's quickly go to the phones before we take another break. We'll start off in Mount Airy with Ron. Welcome, Ron, to Radio Times.
Hi, Ron. I think you're trying to get to me because the line almost went dead. But let me give you my reminiscence, and then you can respond off the air. I was 12 years old when the Watergate hearings were happening, and I've been given my first camera. I learned to practice how to frame an image by taking pictures of my black and white vacuum tube TV. And in fact, I have a photo album that has a picture of Alexander Butterfield with his name on the crawl underneath. And I had no idea who Alexander Butterfield was going to be. But for the rest of the listeners, you might remember that he is the guy who revealed the existence of all the Watergate tapes that were so crucial in getting Richard Nixon to leaving him no alternative but to resign the office. Mm. And I'll take your response off the air.
Well, thank you for your call. It sounds like our listener was becoming something of a journalist in his own right there, Jim.
Absolutely. I had forgotten Alexander Butterworth's name, but I'm sure Chuck didn't, based on how much work he's done on for investigating power on Watergate. But it gets back to what you said at the beginning of the program, Tracy. The whole issue riveted the country in a way, and I think Chuck made this point as well. It was one of those seminal moments where everybody was focusing on every little detail about this thing because there was so much at stake and nobody had ever seen anything like that before.
Yeah. What about journalism schools and what happened after Watergate? Did this kind of reporting, did it make investigative journalism cool, and did a lot more people start to enroll in journalism school?
It definitely did, and everybody that Chuck and I know who's involved in journalism school. Of course, Chuck teaches now in journalism, and I've done numerous things over the years in that area, but it was a huge surge in enrollment in journalism schools, and it was not just investigative reporting, but it was a curiosity about the business, the whole field of covering news and so forth. So it put newspapers on a map in a way they had not been before that. It was suddenly a glamorous, cool thing to do, and people dusted off their movies from the 1930s to see what it was like in those days. But it really was a tremendous upsurge in enrollments and in interest, and we got out of that some tremendously talented people.
Yeah.
I mean, journalism has always been a calling. It has never been a field that people think they're going to get rich in.
Yeah, you don't do it for the paycheck.
You don't do it for the paycheck, and you don't do it for a 40-hour week.
Yeah, that's for sure.
So, and a lot of people who weren't into that soon found that out and did something else.
Yeah.
But a lot of people saw what was there, saw what could be done, and it's really actually given us quite a generation of some very good journalists.
Hmm. Well, speaking of very good journalists, we have a Pulitzer Prize winner joining us in just a few minutes. Eileen Sullivan from the AP will be with us to talk about her series. We are talking about how journalism, investigative in particular, has changed in the years since Watergate. You're listening to Radio Times, and we'll be right back.
WHYY is supported by Choose PA Wind, an initiative designed to help local businesses and homeowners to understand clean, Pennsylvania-sourced wind energy. More information on using wind energy to power homes and businesses at choosepawind.com.
From the shores of the Dead Sea comes one of the most significant archaeological finds of the 20th century, the Dead Sea Scrolls at the Franklin Institute. Featuring more than 600 Holy Land artifacts and a rare glimpse of the authentic Dead Sea Scrolls. Also, a look at millennia-old traditions that continue to impact Western society today. The Dead Sea Scrolls, now open at the Franklin Institute. For tickets, 215-448-1200 or online at fi.edu. The Franklin Institute supports WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Many of President Obama's health care reforms are already on the books. We'll get a primer. What happens if the Supreme Court rejects all or parts of the bill?
Also, the Philadelphia hip-hop duo Chitty Bang on breaking the Guinness Book of World Records for longest freestyle rap, over 9 hours. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
PNC Bank and the Barnes Foundation support WHYY and welcome visitors to the Barnes in Philadelphia to experience the vast collection of Picassos, Matisses, Renoirs, and Cezannes in their new home. For details on tickets and programs, barnesfoundation.org.
You are listening to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscow-Wayne. 40 years after the Watergate break-in, we are talking about the role of investigative journalism and how it's changed since then. We've been talking with Jim Steele of the investigative reporting team of Steele and Barlett, well-known to Philadelphia area readers and national readers as well, for that matter, and Charles Lewis, who is professor and founding editor of the Investigative Reporting Workshop at American University. Joining us now is Associated Press reporter Eileen Sullivan. Eileen and three of her colleagues just won a Pulitzer Prize for their series on the New York Police Department and its widespread surveillance of Muslims after 9/11. Eileen is a graduate of Villanova University. She started her career with the Courier-Post in Cherry Hill. Welcome, Eileen, to Radio Times.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
So first of all, congratulations on the Pulitzer. How wonderful.
Thanks.
I'm sure that is cause for celebration in your newsroom.
Yes, absolutely.
Tell us a little bit, since you are, you know, in the trenches, as our other guests are, in your case, how did you come to uncover the information that led to this Pulitzer Prize-winning series?
Well, I mean, it was a team effort, and it came up in the course of covering other things. Matt and Adam, mm-hmm. Matt Apuzzo and Adam Goldman, were working on some CIA accountability stories and started hearing some terms that they weren't familiar with related to the New York Police Department and their programs and partnerships with the CIA. So they started picking at that and found that the New York Police Department was operating this very sort of sophisticated intelligence division. And they came to me. I cover counterterrorism, and I've covered a lot of what police departments do since 9/11 and how they're sort of trying to develop this intelligence-led policing. And they asked me if this was typical around the country. And in my coverage, it absolutely was not. I mean, the New York Police Department is the only department that has these capabilities. And so we just went from there.
You brought up a couple of things that I want to talk about, and I also want to invite our listeners to join us at 888-477-9499, talking about investigative journalism. You talked about how this was a team effort. There were three other reporters, in addition mm-hmm. to yourself, who worked on this series, sitting here with Jim Steele, who is one half of an investigative reporting team that's been doing a lot of award-winning work for years. Chuck, I'm sure you can chime in on this as well, but I want to ask you, Eileen, just about the idea of the team concept and how important that is to investigative journalism.
Well, I think it's so important because, you know, two good minds are better than one, right? And everyone brings a different skill set to the table. So I think that all four of us really complemented each other. Chris Hawley, who was based in New York, was able to do a lot of good work because he was physically up there. And Matt and Adam and I are used to working together on other things. So we've had a lot of success working as a team.
Jim, talk about your experience in working with Donald Barlett and how, and your chemistry and how you sort of work together.
Well, one of the things that that Eileen just mentioned, I think, is very important, and that is, you know, two heads are better than one. And as part of that whole philosophy, the thing that has been so helpful to us over the years is that the deeper you go into a subject, the more complex it can sometimes be. And no matter how close you may be to your editor or editors, they're not living with it every day. No matter how much you try to keep them informed, they're not actually looking at the primary materials, the documents, the court cases, transcripts of interviews, whatever you've done. So the great value of a team is that not only can you, in effect, do twice as much, but you have a marvelous sounding board, somebody who you can bounce things off of.
Yeah.
Am I crazy here? Or is this do you see this the way I see this? I mean, what do you make of this? And when someone has a background in that subject, they can see that. And what we have found, that it has actually contributed to much stronger stories over the years, because we both see how things are, we both reach those conclusions, we're both firm in our belief that that's what it is. And there's no doubt in our mind, I think, that each one of those efforts comes out stronger because of that. So it's not just doubling the work and the ability to pursue things like that, but you can bring so much more to the table in terms of the strength and the themes and the conclusions you come up with.
So it's the iron sharpens iron.
Absolutely.
Kind of an idea.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Eileen, we were talking earlier in the program about resources and how everyone's doing more with less, as you no doubt well know, and how difficult it is sometimes for an investigative reporter to have the resources of time, funding, the luxury of following through on some of these stories. What has your experience been in that regard?
Well, at the AP, we've been very fortunate. Matt and Adam are on the investigative team, and so they were able to take a good deal amount of time to travel to New York and to, you know, conduct some lengthy interviews. And I work for the same editor, so even though I'm a beat reporter, my editor was able to free me up for certain things in order to pursue this story. And I think that's important. I mean, for reporters who have to cover a beat and, you know, are writing spot stories day to day, if you come onto a good investigative piece, I mean, make the pitch to your editor. This is a story they just can't ignore, and a good editor will make the time for it.
Hmm. Chuck, I want to ask you about that relationship, because Eileen was just talking about the editor-reporter relationship and how critical that is, but there's also a critical relationship between the editor and the owner, right? Or the reporter may not get to do all these things.
Well, that's right, and frequently, well, the best news organizations have terrific editor-publisher relationships. You know, back to the Washington Post, you had Katherine Graham willing to stand up for the paper, the Pentagon Papers, even though they had just gone public and they were being told by some of their bankers and others not to do it. And Ben Bradley pleaded with her, and she did, made the right decision. But you know, frequently there is friction sometimes in these things, of course, and it doesn't always happen the way it ought to happen. But you have to have a publisher that believes in the whole notion of the free press and an enterprising, in-your-face press when it comes to abuses of power. And the editor has to have the backing of the publisher and the best news organizations. And when Jim and Don did their first magic that the world first saw in the 70s, you had some fantastic editors, and the paper was in a magnificent moment in its the zenith years, arguably, where some of them were in those years. When the stars line up perfectly, when you get great reporters, a great editor, and a great publisher, look out. You're going to see some fabulous journalism. And you know, in recent years, as some of these issues have gotten complicated, you don't always see that. And I mean, we could talk deeply about that, and there's some pretty grim stories. But if the publisher is not with it, not interested, or worried about the bottom line, or advertisers doing something, or whatever, then look out that then the editors will be in a difficult spot, kind of caught in the middle, and the reporters will start to even, you know, trim their sails about their own ambitions, about what they want to look at, and you start to get a different kind of journalism, and it's really grim to watch. I don't. It's much more fun to talk about Watergate and the AP Pulitzer Prize. The dark side.
Well, and Jim, you certainly have experienced this because for a host of reasons, owners change, times change, the economy changes, and all of that has an impact.
Absolutely, and I think that's what everybody wonders what the whole future is going to be, because there's so many of these changes coming. Don and I had the great advantage when we were in Philadelphia at the Inquirer, as Chuck just alluded to, of having strong editors and a business side that stayed hands-off, partly because of the strength of that editing core. That was a sacred thing there. When I was a young reporter in Kansas City, there was a marvelous story about the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, which had this famous newspaper, Joseph Pulitzer Jr., won Pulitzer after Pulitzer after Pulitzer in the 30s, 40s, 50s. And there was a story somebody told me that even in those days, the 60s, people from the advertising department were not allowed to get off on the editorial floor. Now, that's probably a little on the extreme side, but it shows you the you know, that firewall that many papers had over them. Some of that has broken down, and some of that is actually okay to break down as long as you don't let things, and when I say break down, you don't have to have that kind of rigidity, and you need to find out what the business is happening and what needs to be done.
Yeah.
But the sacredness of news gathering and the independence of that is really the heart of journalism, whether it's newspapers, magazines, or what have you.
Yeah.
And I think that's what most of us want to make sure at all costs is preserved.
Well, I'm so glad you mentioned the sacredness of news gathering, because I want all of you to weigh in on this as veteran journalists yourselves about the change that we've seen just, let's say, in the last 10 years in journalism, in terms of the content, in terms of, you know, what actually is journalism. In fact, Chuck, you talked with Bernstein about the thriving of the idiot culture,
right.
You know, and just we're seeing, you know, sort of, I think, a dilution of what journalism was meant to be. And I'm interested to hear your perspective on what some organizations are calling journalism these days. So, Eileen, let me start with you, and we'll kind of go around the table here.
Well, I mean, from where I sit, the way it's changed for me is that it's just the platforms have expanded. Obviously, you know, I started out 12 years ago now, or 13, I'm not sure, and we didn't have blogs or anything like that. We were just starting to figure out how to post our stories on the internet, and now that's obviously exploded. It hasn't really changed the way I do my job. I report my stories the same way. I have more resources because of the internet and social media as far as trolling for stories. But for me at the AP, I don't really clash with with some of the new, you know, mediums that you're discussing.
Yeah. Chuck, let's talk about that idiot culture that Bernstein mentioned, and you know, he gave the great example of, you know, Marla Maples being on the cover of, you know, multiple newspapers when there was really big international news going on at the same time.
Yeah, the I think it was the fall of the Berlin Wall and Nelson Mandela getting out of prison, and the three dailies in New York went with Marla Maples, and it wasn't just New York; it was across the country, and he made those observations, by the way, about. He wrote an article about the idiot culture literally 20 years ago, and I said, my God, you wrote that in the 90s. What about now? And he goes, well, obviously it's much worse.
And talk about your self-fulfilling prophecy, right?
Yeah, and so it is. We're sort of in a lowest common denominator situation here with a lot of news organizations in all media forms, not just. For example, TV, which is easy to criticize. It was easy then, and it's easy now, even though I used to work at 60 Minutes. But, I mean, it's not just TV, and it's not just the Internet there. It's also true with newspapers as well. And so this is a problem, and it still comes back to, you know, talented journalists, courageous editors, and interested publishers standing behind the work, whether it's a for-profit commercial realm, a nonprofit like Associated Press, another nonprofit, or whatever the form of the news organization. If you don't have these ingredients of this reporter, editor, publisher connection and commitment, you're going to have schlock journalism. And I wouldn't call it journalism, but some people do schlock, whatever.
Yeah.
And it's really grim to watch. It's just depressing beyond words. You know, I don't know what we do about it, except we have to be better consumers of news ourselves. It's like your diet. If you eat junk, we know what happens. If you consume junk, you have a dumbing down of the population. And, you know, there are signs over the last 10 or 20 years that we've been doing that to ourselves as well.
And Jim Steele, in our last few minutes, I want to talk about that, about how, as consumers of news, we can know when we're getting the good stuff. I mean, there's a lot of stuff out there that supposedly passes for journalism, but for the average reader, listener, viewer, how do you know when you're getting good?
All I can do is tell you my philosophy, and I am of the connect-the-dots school of journalism. There's no one thing you can read at any time. And so I read multiple publications, both newspapers, magazines, not every day.
Mm-hmm.
I read some of these things online. I read some of them that come to me in paper form or tablet form. And so I get my information from a wide range of different things. And I think that's the only salvation for the consumers of news out there. I think one of the things that's happened with this dilution is you see all of these studies about how the media is ranking low. I don't think we're as low as lawyers on most of these public opinion polls, but we're getting down there in some way. And I think it's what we're talking about here. A lot of this kind of material that's out there is turning off a lot of readers.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of this is in the electronic field. But yet print gets lumped in with this whole thing. Chuck and I were just at a convention over the weekend. We both just happened to be there, Investigative Reporters and Editors Convention in Boston. And while there's a lot of this junk out there, you go to a convention like that and you see, still in the midst of all of these difficulties, how much outstanding work is still being done.
Yeah.
By young people, middle-aged people, older people, who are carrying the torch for this business, who are doing the work or verifying information, who are getting that information out there to the public. It's happening all over the country. Not as much as we'd like to see, not as much as we used to see, but there's still a lot of that going on, and that gives me some hope.
Yeah, Chuck, that's got to be a heartening thing.
Well, it is. 1,200 people, the second highest attendance in the history of IRE, which was created a year or two after Nixon resigned, back to Watergate. And so when you see that the craft and the profession and the commitment continues, it is incredibly inspiring. And I think a lot of us go to these events annually. It's like going to the well or something.
True. So true.
Yeah, and so you need it as well, but it's really spectacular. And you learn from your colleagues. You learn what they've investigated, and they did certain techniques. And, you know, anyway, it's inspiring, and we need that.
And Eileen, in 10 seconds or less, your advice to consumers of news, how to get the good stuff.
Read the AP.
Sound words indeed, right? Well, I want to thank all of you for being with us. Jim Steele has been with us. And by the way, your new book is coming out, The Betrayal of the American Dream. Stay tuned for that. It'll be out in August of this year, and we will look forward to that. Chuck Lewis, thank you for being with us and sharing your insights and for the wonderful website. What a tremendous resource Investigating Power is. It has been wonderful, and we've enjoyed talking with you as well. And Eileen Sullivan, congratulations again on the Pulitzer Prize, and thank you for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moskowain, and you've been listening to Radio Times.